This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Cataracts are the world's leading cause of avoidable blindness. The metaverse can help address that problem. A virtual reality platform created by Fundamental VR and Orbis International helps train doctors to treat cataracts, resulting in more confident surgeons operating all over the world. With virtual reality training, surgeons can practice over and over to gain skills. Meta and the metaverse are having impact today.
Across Northern Ireland, on your radio and on BBC Sounds. This is
the Stephen Nolan Show.
Good morning, everyone. So after Sir Geoffrey Donaldson's court case yesterday, we're thinking about and asking questions about how careful the mainstream media is around the laws of contempt and around protecting our judicial system. And what can sometimes be the Wild West on social media? And how should the authorities, and what can the authorities do, and what can we as the public do to protect the integrity of our judicial system, as there are some people with no knowledge of that court case expressing opinion online. All coming up with Nolan this
week. The Stephen Nolan Show!
Warning signs. Very much warning signs outside the court yesterday, Newry Courthouse, as video footage has emerged online of people hurling abuse at Sir Geoffrey Donaldson as he left court. The media lawyer, Joshua Rosenberg, with us this morning. Joshua, good morning to you. Joshua's coming in a second or two. The number 03030 80 55 55. Joshua with us this morning. Joshua, good morning to you.
Good morning, Stephen.
I was saying, Joshua, just a matter of seconds ago, warning signs now, and this needs to be nipped in the bud before it goes too far.
It does. I'm not trying to put ideas in anybody's minds, but you have seen trials in Northern Ireland, people accused of sexual offences, where much more information has been published. You certainly can't name alleged victims. You certainly can't publish any of the evidence you might have come across, whether it's true or not. The sort of thing we saw published today about what happened yesterday, I don't think has gone too far, but anything that went further could stop a fair trial taking place.
So for those people who are now, you had a crowd of people hurling, they have no idea about the details of the case. They're hurling abuse at Sir Geoffrey as he was walking out of that court yesterday, then publishing it online. What signal do the authorities need to send those people about the potential rules around contempt of court? Well, the real rules, they're not potential, the rules around contempt of court, Joshua.
Absolutely. It's quite possible that the Public Prosecution Service, maybe the Attorney General, would indicate to people that everybody is entitled to a fair trial and that mustn't be prejudiced by remarks that could damage a fair trial. In one sense, the insults that were being shouted was just really an insulting way of repeating the allegations against Sir Geoffrey. He is, after all, facing 11 charges, one of rape, one of gross indecency involving a child, and 9 counts of indecent assault. Now, it's perfectly permissible for us to report that. Indeed, the BBC has reported that, and that's perfectly lawful. And if people are simply saying the same thing but in cruder language, well, that's probably okay. And indeed, you know, you don't want to be too precious about it. Only this week in London, the High Court threw out an attempt by a government law officer to bring proceedings against a demonstrator, a protester, who held up a sign as members of a jury went into a court to try a criminal case. And the law officer, the Solicitor General for England and Wales, was refused permission to bring contempt of court proceedings there. And if you look at the Contempt of Court Act 1981, which I think does apply in Northern Ireland, That deals with contempt of court, which can be caused without any intention of doing that. And it says that the strict liability rule, as it's called, applies only to a publication which creates a substantial risk that the course of justice and the proceedings will be seriously impeded or prejudiced. So what the authorities have to do is to look at what's been said, what has been published above all, and decide, is that really just sort of noisy protests that aren't going to do any damage, or is it actually going to influence people who might serve on a jury, even a judge?
Some might argue that the potential danger here is that we know how content on Twitter, on Facebook, on other social media platforms can become viral very, very quickly. It can snowball very, very quickly, which is why it will be interesting to see at what point does the judge who will protect that case and the integrity of the system at all times, and indeed the Attorney General, at what point do they say this is not acceptable online?
Judges are very reluctant to throw out cases, even though defendants often say, look, I can't get a fair trial because of all this adverse publicity. That's the last thing judges want to do. It's not fair to the defendant. It's not fair to the prosecution service. The Attorney General may want to step in very soon and put up the sort of warning we've been talking about, just to remind people that they don't know, and if they do know any information about the case, they certainly shouldn't publish it because it could stop this trial going ahead if it gets that bad. It's quite difficult for a judge, it's quite difficult for the authorities to decide when prejudice has got bad, but nevertheless, there have been cases, even before social media, where a case has been thrown out because it's simply not possible for the defendant to have a fair trial because of all the speculation.
Okay, Joshua, thank you very much. Good morning to you today. Alison Morris from the Belfast Telegraph with us this morning. Good morning, Alison.
Good morning.
Many publications are describing this as chaotic scenes. Yesterday, as Sir Geoffrey Donaldson left the court, it seemed to be that he was standing there for a while and then had to go back into court. What happened?
Yeah, it was shambolic, I suppose I would call it. So what happened originally, he had obviously been in contact with the car of whoever it was coming to pick him up, and they arrived. They were sort of slightly down from the gate. He tried to come out. He was with his solicitor, John McBurney. There was a crowd had gathered. When he was arriving for court, there was a few members of the public just standing around. They were doing absolutely no harm. But by the time he was coming out of court, a huge crowd had gathered across the road. And again, the majority of them were doing no harm, but there were some who were clearly there intent on causing trouble. And at one point, one in particular had surged forward when Mrs. Donaldson came out, and he was battering and banging on the window of the car that was picking her up and shouting abuse at her. And myself and some of the other reporters had actually said to one of the police officers, look, that guy there is going to end up really hurting someone, you know, including one of us. Could he be moved, or could you just keep an eye on him? But he did. The same person is the person, I suppose, the videos online, which, you know, would clearly be contempt if anyone repeated them. The same person then came forward again. There was quite a few people who were just being nosy, basically, but then there was others who were there clearly to cause some kind of hassle. He came out, he wasn't able to get to the car because this crowd surged forward, and, you know, the media, obviously, were not blameless either. There was a large media contingent as well of photographers trying to get a picture of him, but there just wasn't enough police officers even back inside the court again. And then he came out, the police tried to form a sort of a corridor, if you like. You know, they linked arms and tried to form a safe corridor. They managed this time to get him into the car. But again, you know, the same two people. I mean, one of the police officers that was standing beside me was covered in spit by the end of it. Someone had spat all over him as what? He was trying to push them back. He actually said to me, there's spit running down the back of my neck. Somebody had spat all over him, and they were bashing, you know, they were banging the windows of the car, and they'd surrounded the car. It was actually quite a dangerous situation at one stage. And, you know, the way Newry Courthouse is, there's quite a big road outside of it, you know, a sort of two lane road. I mean, to me, and far be it for me to tell any, you know, tell a police officer how to do the job. They know how to do the job better than I do. But it seemed to me, had that road just been closed at both sides for 5 or 10 minutes to allow both of the defendants to leave the court and get into their car, it would have caused quite minor traffic disruption for a few minutes, and that would have been it. It would have seemed to me much safer. There was no barriers holding the public back. There was no metal barriers. It could have been predicted. We've all known for 4 weeks that his first court appearance was yesterday and that it was in Newry. You know, it wasn't that any of this was a secret. It was well publicised. So there was always going to be people who were going to show up in order to see that, you know, but as I said, the majority of them were just people, they were filming on their phones and they were being nosy, but there was, I would say, maybe 4 or 5 who were there clearly intent on causing hassle.
So they didn't have those crowd barriers either side?
No, nothing at all. You know, and the police officers who were there were really trying. I felt sorry for some, and the majority of them are women as well. You know, there was a lot of female officers and they were being pushed and shoved around the place. And, you know, it would have made more sense to have even a line of police facing where the public were, just to sort of hold them across the road. But they could have still seen things, you know, you're not, you know, hemming anyone in where they can't see what's going on. But it would have kept them, I suppose, from surging forward in the way that they did. You know, if there was a threat to either, like a genuine threat to either Jeffrey Donaldson and all those police officers, someone could have caused serious harm yesterday. I mean, they could have caused serious harm to him or to one of the police. There wasn't enough there to control them. And some of them were really, really aggressive. One of my colleagues, she gets shunted around the place and pushed and shoved. You know, one of the other journalist beside me got pushed and shoved quite a lot, and you know, it did get a bit chaotic and dangerous near the end. And you know, as well as that, remember, you know, we just listened to very, very serious charges being put to the two defendants here. Clearly we know we're pleading not guilty, but also, you know, for the first time we heard the details of those charges and that there are two complainants in that. And you know, anyone watching that who, you know, might be inclined to come forward and report something or whatever, you'd be looking at that and going, that's a zoo, it's just chaos.
Yeah, and Alison, they both say that they will strenuously, contest the charges, but they haven't pled yet.
No, not as yet, because that doesn't happen on a first appearance. What happened was a detective got into the showed up at court. He said he could connect the two to the charges. The charges were read and they were put to them. Both of them were asked to confirm their date of birth, which they did, and they were asked, did they understand the charges? And both replied, I do, to that, and that was it. It was a very short hearing. There was a bit of discussion about changes to bail arrangements, and that was more or less it. I mean, it was literally over, you know, over in 10 minutes.
So I guess after day one, what we're asking, certainly from this programme, is there will be many court appearances still to come. Should there be a change in the police tactics of controlling the safe passage of people involved in that court case? Was that a successful policing operation yesterday? You know, I watched the footage. You were there on the ground. Those police officers, you know, money wouldn't pay you to be standing in the middle of that, getting pushed and shoved around. Is there any learning for the PSNI? You know, if you have Sir Jeffrey Donaldson essentially for a short period of time stranded, not able to move, as you say, what if there had been any type of security incident there? He's standing there stranded. And then the second aspect of it is, where do the Attorney General and the judge of the case, where do they draw the line? What do they publicly say, given the potential for abuse from ill-informed people who haven't a clue about this case, shouting and potentially prejudicing a trial if this was to gain momentum online? What do they do?
Well, I have recorded on my phone what happened when both Jeffrey Donaldson and his wife came out of the court to leave, and I couldn't post those videos because those were the videos cased contained blatant contempt because of what was being shouted and the abuse that was being shouted. So the you couldn't publish them because of that. So
and yet some people have. Published.
Yeah, one of the people who clearly is the person who I pointed out to police when we had said, look, he's going to end it, because he pushed, you know, he pushed where I was, and he was clearly very aggressive, and, you know, he pushed one of my colleagues. That was when Mrs. Donaldson was leaving, several of us had pointed him out to police and said, look, you need to watch that guy there, you know, he's clearly here to cause trouble. Could you keep him back out of the way just whenever we're doing this, we're trying to work? And, you know, he did exactly the same thing twice, obviously twice, because Jeffrey Donaldson came out, he couldn't get his car in back, and then he came back out again, and both times. And, you know, that person, I have actually seen videos and I know it was that person who posted them, because I was standing beside and I could hear what he was shouting, so I know they're his videos.
Well, look, if there are police officers that that have been spat on, and you're stating...
He was spat on, I did say it.
So therefore, the police will have had body cam. I wonder, will the authorities set a marker down from day one here? Will they be seen now to go after someone that was behaving inappropriately within that crowd? Because as I say, this is only the beginning of this court process.
Well, yeah, well, what I will say is this: the two defendants are now excused from appearing in person until the later stages of this court case. And I would be shocked if once that gets to the sort of PE stage of that that court proceedings, that they are in Newry. I would imagine that will be moved to Belfast, because it's much easier for the police to control people at Belfast court, because it's obviously in the city centre. It's a much easier security operation than maybe, you know, a court like Newry. But they are excused from appearing, which will obviously put an end to the sort of carry on that went on yesterday. I mean, when I arrived, I was speaking to you, you know, yesterday morning before we went in the court, and it was quite calm, and there was a lot of media around, a lot of people. You know, as I said, there was both the local media, there was national media, there was international media. There was a huge number of photographers and cameramen, videographers and all sorts of things. And there was only a few members of the public who were just, I mean, they were generally being curious. They were asking us questions and they were causing no harm whatsoever. But by the time we came back out again, we could see there was a huge collection of people had gathered across the road. Again, the majority of them were just being nosy, that their phones out filming, but they weren't doing anything. But there was about four or five who were... You know, one who kept having his hood up and kept surging forward and couldn't repeat the abuse that he was shouting. This other person who, you know, who we'd all, everyone in the media had basically pointed out and says, look, this guy's going to end up hurting somebody, could you do something about him? And he was left to run riot, and he was filming things as well while he was screaming and shouting abuse. And as I said, all of that abuse was complete contempt of court. It couldn't be published. I mean, they're on my phone, those videos, but I could never show them to anyone or send them or post them because of what's said on them.
So here we have a modern day contemporary example of how journalists and mainstream publications are very much, as we should, to the letter of the law, respecting the contempt of court rules. And here you have other people then saying what they want in an ill-informed way. And what will the authorities do about that? Is it possible, Alison? Why am I frightened of saying this? I'll say it. Is it possible that the media pushed too far yesterday, in that there were so many of them? Did they cause an intensity for the police? I know the journalists were just doing their job, but was everyone scrambling for a photograph?
Yeah, there was more media than I've ever seen outside a courtroom, and I've covered some huge court cases, and, you know, we get a lot of media that do would be outside the court waiting to get that picture of someone coming in or out, but I've never seen anything like that. And yeah, there was a lot of pushing and shoving, where people trying to get, you know, that first picture, because he hadn't been photographed since we heard of his resignation that Good Friday. There's been no pictures of him from that Wednesday of that week is the last time he was seen publicly. So clearly there was a big rush to get that picture and get that film. And yeah, there was a lot of media as well. He was clearly, you know, causing the police a bit of a headache, but it could have been so much better managed. You know, I think if the police had thought that through, if they had put barriers up, if they had thought that through,
Alison,
there just didn't seem to be a lot of planning ahead. They assumed maybe a handful of people would show up. I don't think that they planned for the amount of people who did show up.
Well, look, in my understanding, not of this case, but in my understanding, I've watched different operations that the PS and I have done, both from the outside, and I've had access over the years, as I'm sure you have, to how the PS and I operate. That will have been thought through to the point where there will have been a whole group of senior police officers planning through the what ifs of that and discussing it with Gold Command and Silver Command and all their structures within the PSNI. And they didn't have crowd barriers up. You're saying that they lost control of it. So there was
a bronze command on the street. I know this just because it said bronze command on the back of their jacket. So I know that there was one police officer who was doing that. I didn't count them, but you mean there was a significant amount of police there. But I think that they were more, they seemed to be thinking they were there to do maybe a wee bit of traffic control, and that would have been more or less it. They didn't, I don't think, plan. I mean, I did say, you know, when I was writing that they were caught on the hop, and that really did seem to me what happened. They hadn't expected as many media to show up, and I don't know why, because this case is probably, you know, for my younger colleagues, it's clearly the biggest case that they have ever covered in their careers. I don't think they expected so many media. And as I said, on the way in, there was a few people just hanging around and milling around, having a nosy, but doing absolutely no harm. But on the way out, you know, that crowd had swollen quite considerably. You know, Newry's not a big place, and, you know, there was a lot of people just came around to see. And as I said, most of them were, you know, standing across the road with their phones out just filming, because it was a quite a bizarre sight. But there was, I would say, four or five hardcore who were there to cause hassle, and they managed to do that, you know, deliberately cause hassle.
So will they be back in the next media court appearance?
We're blameless, because we're clearly not blameless in this. There was a lot of media surge forward, and the police were shouting at us as much as they were shouting at the public.
Stay there just now a couple of minutes, Alison, if you can. The commentator, Malachy Docherty, with us this morning. Good morning, Malachy.
Morning, Stephen. Morning, Alison.
I'm really interested going forward here, as I'm sure the authorities are, as I'm sure the judge will be, as I'm sure the Attorney General will be, as to there is very little danger from the mainstream publications, because they understand and they know the law. How are the authorities going to maintain their authority and the integrity of the justice system for people who not only don't know the law, but don't care about the law?
Well, I think this is a very serious problem. I mean, we have an awful lot of fake news or speculative news on social media, a huge amount of rumour mongering, and a lot of people now don't bother with the mainstream media. They take all their news from social media because they think the social media is much more open, tells them more. They know that we in the mainstream media hold facts back, and that is a fact about this case. We are holding facts back. And we must, and we know why we must. But still in all, that creates a contrast between the way in which mainstream media does things and which social media does things. We have the problem that you raised of contempt of court. The other problem is the danger, and the police have already intervened on Twitter or X or whatever we call it now, to say that people who are speculating on the names of the complainants are putting themselves in serious danger of going to jail, because that is a criminal offence. Still in all, you know, we have this dichotomy, if you like, of two kind of media universes, one which is governed by rules and regulations and is cognizant of the law and responsibility to the judicial system, and one which isn't. And you know, how we negotiate a world in which those two universes clash with each other, that is the problem. Because another part of this, I think, is that people within the justice system, people who have used the justice system with complaints about sexual offences, particularly against them in the past, have complained that they have not seen justice done for themselves. And so there is anger out there. And we saw that around the rugby rape trial a few years ago, that people were turning up to protest at the court. And I was down there. I must say, Alison's report, by the way, there was fantastic. I mean, that was the best thing I've heard on the whole thing. But I was at the rugby rape trial, and you could see among the people who were protesting that there were weeping women, that there were people who were hurt, that there were people who had stories to tell about past experience of the judicial system and the sense that they'd been failed by it.
And the defendants in that case were ultimately cleared of any wrongdoing.
And yet despite that, we saw this huge splurge of social media rejecting that ruling. So what I'm saying is,
from ill-informed people, because what we've got to take our marker from.
I don't want to be saying that
Sorry.
Yeah, go ahead.
Go ahead. Alison.
Can I just point out as well, though, that we all know the verdict. I covered the rugby rape trial as well. I sat in court and the carry on of members of the public and the public gallery during that was atrocious. But that trial was, you know, caused, I think, so much public discourse that it prompted the Gillen Review. Our entire process of how we trial sexual crimes in this country was changed because of that trial. So, you know, while we know the verdict, and actually I agreed with the verdict because the prosecution didn't prove their case in that trial, I stepped through it, but it also caused so much damage in terms of victims who were maybe thinking about coming forward, who watched that and went, not a chance am I putting myself through that Judge Gillen had to completely overhaul our entire system. And I, you know, anyone who's interested in these type of cases, I suggest you read the Gillen Review. It's probably one of the best documents I've ever seen in terms, and the recommendations and that to change how we run these type of cases. And that, you know, doesn't seem to have trickled down when you see what happened yesterday.
Can I also ask an analysis? In terms of inside the courtroom, there was a link so that people outside court could be watching the proceedings. And I was reading a report of how a farmer had been watching it, and they had difficulty getting his mic turned off. Is that right?
Stephen, honestly, I mean, there's things that I've seen in court, and there's things, you know, that I have looked at and thought, am I actually sitting through this, or is this some kind of sitcom? So the site link, for people who don't know, we have a site link system that was set up during COVID, basically to allow the courts to operate while people couldn't be in the same room together. But it's continued on, because it's really useful in terms of not having to bring prisoners from custody to stand in a court instead of just appear via video link. But also, you know, solicitors and barristers who may be working in two or three courts in the same day can tune in the site link, but also members of the public. The site link in the Erie Court yesterday, once it had 80 people on it, that was obviously the interest in it. But people who had maybe never used the site link before and didn't understand how it works. So when you go on the site link, you have to both turn your camera off and mute your microphone so that nobody can hear you. A guy appeared on the screen standing in a cow shed. I am not joking yet. He was standing in a cow shed. I could hear cows mooing and dogs barking in the background. And this guy with his face up to the camera. And the poor court clerk kept saying to him, could you please mute your microphone? But he didn't even know she was speaking. And this went on maybe for a
good
4 or 5
minutes.
So what
were they doing? Were they hearing animal noises then?
I could hear the noise in the farm.
And none of this is funny given the context of the court and the very serious charges and the very
well,
serious.
This was before the case had started, and at this point in time, the two defendants hadn't even been brought into the court. There was other business. There was 90 odd people on the list in Newry Court, Magistrates Court 3. It was a really busy court. Clearly, these people weren't tuning in for everything else that was going on. They were tuning in for the biggest case that was going to be heard that day. But yeah, there was a guy in a cow shed. There was also people who were sitting beside me who were quite innocently curious, and they had come in to sit, and you know, they sat in the public gallery, and you know, they were, you know, at one stage one said, could there was a break in the proceedings now, could they take their lunch out and eat it? And I was like, no, you can't eat in a court. But I mean, you could see that, you know, the case is clearly, as this goes through the court process, which will take a very long time, we know our court runs very slowly, there's a backlog in our court system, as this processes through the court, and when it comes to those more substantive hearings, which will take place when it goes up to the higher court, to the Crown Court, you know, there is going to have to be, you know, thought given to the fact that there is such huge public interest in this case, that there is real potential for there to be contempt. And remember also when Maliki was saying about that rugby trial, part of the Gillen Review was the fact that members of the public came in and sat in the public gallery during that trial, and then they posted the name of the complainant online, a person who had lifelong anonymity. Just as the complainants in this case have lifelong anonymity, the only person who can remove that themselves, they're the only people who can waive that. And that person's anonymity was repeatedly breached because members of the public were sitting in the court and listening to proceedings and then going outside and posting online what they'd heard.
Finally, Maliki, we'll leave the last word to you. And Alison, thank you very much indeed for your reporting this morning. Maliki, as this goes forward, this is not just a danger for our judicial system. This is surely an opportunity. You know, Judge Eamon King is presiding over the magistrate part of these proceedings at the moment. he needs protected in terms of the integrity of his court, and he will be protecting himself, keeping that integrity. This is an opportunity for the authorities to show that you will not get away with breaking the law or going anywhere close to it, and you will be held to the same level of accountability as any mainstream operation. This is an opportunity for them.
Well, I agree with you there, Stephen, but at the same time, people, it will need to be clearly explained to people very emphatically why there are, will be restrictions on reporting, why some things cannot be said in the public domain, because people, Alison will be covering the trial. It'll be fantastic, but Alison herself knows that there will be things that she will not be able to say. She will not be able to tell the full story. You and I understand that, and we accept that because we know the law and we know the media practice and so on. But an awful lot of people don't. And when they know that the media is holding back information from them for whatever reason, there is a default suspicion of that.
Well,
you know, and so aside from people will go to jail, I am sure, for some of the tweets that they've put out, you know, jeopardizing the identity of the complainants. People will go to jail. But it will have to be clearly explained to the public why that has happened and why this, these rules must not be broken.
Malachy and Alison, thank you very much indeed. We were talking about the budget yesterday. Our business economics business editor, John Campbell, wasn't available yesterday. So we get the real deal today. John's back. Morning, John.
Good morning.
Good morning. I was trying to fly yesterday without you, John. It's not a good idea. So
okay, I must listen back to that.
Yeah, you can score me. So look, ministers, essentially in a nutshell, ministers have asked for £2 billion more than what we've got, right?
Yes.
And the finance minister is going to present, lay down her proposals for a budget today. Is that what's going on?
Yeah. Yes, what will happen is the finance minister will bring a budget paper to the executive when they meet this morning, starting about 11 o'clock. And that will include the proposed allocations, the financial allocations for each of the Stormont departments for this financial year. And those numbers have been arrived at following effectively what's been a process of negotiation with her fellow ministers over the last number of weeks. So the hope, maybe the expectation, is that those allocations can be agreed. We will then get to see them and we'll hear from some of the ministers. Now, it's not 100% certain that they could be agreed. Some of the ministers could object and they may have to adjourn for further discussion. But we are working on the basis that we're likely to get the budget today.
So that's the bit that I wanted to ask you about. When this Sinn Féin finance minister, Caoimhe Archibald, is coming forward and laying down proposals as to who gets what. Has that already been agreed with the different ministers, even if not officially, behind the scenes? You know, would Caoimhe Archibald be laying this down without knowledge that the parties are likely to sign up to it?
No, because there has been this process of engagement which will happen with the minister and the other departments and also with the advisers between in the different departments. So it may not be that everybody is, well, to be honest, by this stage, the papers will have been circulated, so everybody at this stage will know what the numbers are. But in terms of getting there, it won't be a complete surprise to anybody, but people may still object when it comes to these final discussions. So, you know, we don't know exactly what happens in the room around the executive table, but we'll get a sense, I suppose, by lunchtime, if something has been agreed. And like I say, there is still the possibility that they may have to adjourn for further discussions. But, you know, by this stage, the process of setting the budget has been going on really since the executive returned.
And you've got the likes of Robin Swan. He's already publicly said he needs £1 billion just to stand still. Yeah. The outgoing health minister, Robin Swan. You have the likes of Paul Given, from the DUP. He needs round about 300 odd million, close to 400 million for a schools project, doesn't he? That he doesn't have enough money for. So will those ministers accept that their projects that they've said they want to do are not going to happen? Or will they be publicly fighting in the days to come for that money?
I don't know. We heard the Deputy First Minister yesterday talking about the need for prioritisation. So, you know, it's obvious all the money isn't there to do everything that they want to do. So, you know, in terms of a childcare strategy as well, although, you know, that we don't actually have a firm proposal for that. The education minister was saying that, you know, to deliver that might cost 400 million a year. I just don't think they have that money.
But he's already started it, hasn't he? He got 150 million. Paul, sorry, we're talking about two different things here. But Paul Given, yeah, in terms of the project in OMA, has already started that project and doesn't have the money to finish it. What happens there?
I don't know. But the bottom line is they don't have all the money to do everything they'd like to do. And generally what happens in a government is you have a sense of collective responsibility where you say, yes, we accept this, and we're going to have to prioritise, and some things will be higher priority than others. If they agree a budget, would a minister immediately come out and say, I don't like this budget? That would seem to be quite unusual if they've just agreed to it. But I suppose we will, in the weeks ahead, get a better sense of what it will mean for each department, because today we don't get the sense of how this filters down into individual programmes. Mainly what we get today is just a headline allocation for each department, and then we can compare it to what they previously had. But, you know, there's no other way to cut this. There are many things that they would like to do. They don't have the budget covered to do all of them. And they probably just about have the budget cover to stand still at best.
I was reading some of Stephen Beacom's copy last night from the Belfast Telegraph. He was quoting Gordon Lyons as saying, Minister Gordon Lyons is saying that there isn't, you know, they would like to build Casement Park. They should build Casement Park, but there isn't enough money. Like, where politically does that go?
Yeah, well, I suppose what that gets back to Westminster, which is, basically, it was a UK government idea that the euros should be a casement, and so that they should stump up the money is effectively the Stormont minister's kind of position on that. You know, in terms of the overall capital budget, you know, it will be about £1.8 billion. To be honest, you could give all the entire capital budget to NI Water easily to do what they need to do, but clearly you can't do that because you have all the other competing priorities around roads and so forth.
So make this real for me, John, in terms of what are we, the public, likely to experience here because of this this budget shortfall, if you like? You know, will the grass still be cut on the verges of the roads? Will the potholes still be fixed? Where are we at?
It's the further degradation of public services, which you can see every day.
Significant further degradation.
I don't know. We'd have to hear what the individual ministers will say. But if they're telling us, here's the amount of money that we need to stand still, and they get less than that money, then that implies that they're going backwards and services get worse.
And if, setting aside water charges, we hear about revenue raising. Is there any other revenue raising mechanism that could bring in the amount of money we need to fill that 2 billion? Now, they've all asked for more than they know they're going to get, presumably. But is there anything that could fix this, bar Westminster intervention?
Not 2 billion. I don't see that it would be viable that they would be able to raise that much locally, it's just politically or practically. You know, there clearly are more things they could do if they wanted to. I think in terms of the talks they're having with the UK government at the moment about an overall financial settlement for Northern Ireland and how that should work, the expectation on the UK side is that the executive do have to show some willingness to raise more revenue. And we should remember that in the deal which restored Stormont, there is the commitment to raise about 130 million in additional revenues over the next 2 years. So that's kind of already baked into the plans, effectively. But you take all the revenue raising measures, which say the Independent Fiscal Commission looked at, and if you were to, you know, do everything, and you were to, you know, have water charges and higher rates and all the rest of it, you would probably at the very best raise about additional 700 million a year. So that clearly doesn't get you anywhere near 2 billion. So that is why they're talking in terms of with the UK government. It's an overall fiscal settlement around what they do in terms of public sector reform, what they might do in terms of revenue raising, what they might do in terms of the formula by which money is allocated from Westminster, and what they might do in terms of additional borrowing power. So this is all in the mix but it's not just one thing which fixes it. But yes, there are clearly options there to raise more revenue, and not all of those have been ruled out.
And what, John, if the budget isn't signed off? What happens?
Well, the politicians just continue to negotiate on it. You know, the lights still stay on. There's by this stage, given all the travails the budget has been through over the last number of years, there's a kind of a well understood and operated procedure to make sure that the money continues to flow and that the officials still have the legal authority to spend. So the money keeps flowing, but in terms of a strategic approach to budgeting, well, then that just gets worse as well.
One last question. If you have the permanent secretaries who are legally required to remain within budget, if you had a minister giving a ministerial direction saying, I'm spending this money anyway, I'm instructing you to build that school, I'm instructing you to fund that project, no, we don't have the money, but I'm instructing you to do it, ultimately they can overspend, can't they?
Yeah, so that's what's happened the last 2 years at Stormont, is there was an overspend. And in that situation, Stormont actually can't technically overspend. It has to draw money down from what's the UK government reserve, and then it's required usually to spend that money back, or to pay that money back the following year. And there actually was an overspend a long time ago as well, around the time of the kind of welfare reform row. Part of the deal reached with the UK government was that the overspend in the last 2 years would be written off, subject to some fairly light conditionality. But yes, ultimately, if Stormont overspends, then it's expected to pay that money back in the following year, although that hasn't happened, I think, probably due to the extraordinary circumstances of the last couple of years.
Just one last question. If these ministers overspent to the point of the 2 billion quid, so in other words, that they have overspent to such a ridiculous stage that the British government couldn't expect it to be paid back within 1 year because Northern Ireland would cease to function. In other words, have they got the option or the ability to say, do you know what, we're underfunded here, we're spending what we need to spend, and park the political problem at the door of the British government? Could they do that legally?
Well, that would be an interesting political conundrum or constitutional conundrum. I suppose ultimately the issue is that it's the UK government that it's got the control of the purse strings. What's happening today is fundamentally an allocation of the money which arises from the Treasury, the 14.5 billion for day-to-day spending. That comes through the block grant. So it would be a very high-risk strategy to basically say to the people who give you the money, we're spending more than you're giving us. You know, because then the question is, well, what do they do in the following years?
OK. John Campbell, thank you very much indeed. Thank you, sir. Patrick Mulholland is with us from NIPSA today. Good morning, Patrick.
Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning, Patrick. And I'm with that demand on money, the reality that we don't have enough money. We were reporting yesterday about imminent strike action, and I hear that's now in the news today, Patrick.
Well, yes, there's a number of areas that I think we can expect to see industrial action unless there's significant steps taken over the next short period of time. There's industrial action has now begun in the health service, in the family and childcare services. Now, I think it is fair to say, Stephen, it's not directly budget related. It's not quite like that in its nature. It's more about structural and systemic failure to manage the workforce.
But it costs money to fix it to the point you want it fixed. It costs money. And the money.
Well, it would cost a certain amount of money, Stephen, but if I can explain it, the budget in family and childcare exists for this. It's already there. The problem is, so basically, family and childcare in Belfast, I can give the example, it should have 300 social workers working in it. It has about 200, 220, something in that region, but they are funded for 300. So the money is there. So it's not really of you know, quite the same nature. I would imagine that probably a lot of government departments may be looking a little bit sideways to see where they can skim money. So it's not quite the same. But
So this strike action in itself, in family and childcare services, can you just explain to me in layman's terms what those services are?
So the areas that are covered by this would be child protection. Most people, you know, have a grasp of what that would be. There's also
I don't have a full grasp. Is that social workers going out if a child is in danger and getting the kid out of the house? Or does that include that?
That sort of thing. That's a good so way of describing it.
How can your members withdraw a service like that?
Do you want me to finish the sentence, Stephen? Right. Child protection issues, but then family support as well. And the family support, the idea of that is to make sure that the supports are in place so that children don't end up having to go into care, etc. So we are taking a very specific form of industrial action here, and we're very conscious and very aware of the problems and the trials and tribulations that are around this particular action. Can I say, first of all, the action that begins today, Stephen, is action short of strike action. It will begin in Belfast. It will roll to the Northern Trust next week, I think it is, then the South Eastern Trust, then Southern, then Western.
And what is short of strike action? What does that mean?
That's what I want to try and describe to you. The approach we're taking is perhaps unique in industrial action terms. We believe the service is not being provided to families and it is not being provided to children, and that the department and the trust are not dealing with the reality of this. So the steps that we are taking are designed to ensure the service is delivered. So what we are talking about is safe staffing, so as our members can do the work safely, but also what we are saying is we want safe delivery of service to children. And what that means is we will continue to do the core elements of the work, the bits that make sure nobody falls through the safety net, but we are also taking steps to say the peripheral things, the sort of white elephants, the vanity projects will not be done. That's the approach that we are taking. So what we have said to the minister is, we had a meeting with the minister on Tuesday, what we have said to the minister is, you put nothing on the table to provide safe staffing, we are now going to go and implement it.
So what services, when they're short of strike action, I'm just trying to be clear what services won't happen as normally do.
Well, the sorts of things that maybe will become very, very apparent is that at this point in time, what tends to happen is people are overloaded with caseloads. So say 150 children's names are put against individuals or put against a team of workers, that they are responsible for those children and they are providing a service for those children. Let me finish the point, Megan Stephen.
All I did was breathe.
Sorry. I know this is hard to get your head around, but basically what tends to happen is these names are put against people, and that means then nobody has responsibility apart from the individual social worker. But everybody knows they're not being seen. Everybody knows that the work's not being carried out. So what we are now going to say is, where the capacity doesn't exist to carry out that work, that name is passed back to the senior manager, the chief executive of the trust, the minister for health. They become the responsible people who then have to deal with that and allocate that appropriately. So it's symbolic, but it's important symbolic. What we are saying is,
well,
the truth of the matter is, we are not, the service in Northern Ireland, family and childcare service, is not protecting children sufficiently. It is not protecting families.
But can you give a guarantee that vulnerable children will not be at increased risk because of your industrial action?
Yeah. What we can actually say, Stephen, is at this moment in time, vulnerable children are at risk now and have been last year, the year before that, and the year before that. It is our belief, let me finish, it is our belief that the action that we are now going to engage in means that we will decrease the vulnerability and the longer term, well, we will eliminate the vulnerability as much as any service can.
The Health Minister Robin Swan has recognised the sustained pressure, he says, that social workers are facing. He says his department, Health and Social Care Trust, are undertaking a series of both short and longer term actions to ensure that social workers have safe and manageable workloads. This includes, they say, a programme of workforce and service reform to drive forward a range of improvements.
Yeah. We have engaged extensively with the health trusts. We have engaged extensively with the department on these issues. It is a most extraordinary circumstance where you go into a room with employers, and remember, this is all the health trusts and the department, and every single person in the room accepts that there is a real crisis, that that crisis has been sustained over a considerable period of time, that it is getting worse by the day, and that something needs to be done to address it. Everybody agrees that. And just to make a point, Stephen, this is social workers who are visiting families, looking after vulnerable children. Many of the units who are now dealing with this are 30% plus below the number of staff that they should have in place. So that's the vulnerability. But we have engaged in discussions around steps that can be taken to try and ameliorate this situation. So far, those discussions have taken us, I wouldn't quite say nowhere, but they certainly have not taken us anywhere close to where we need to be.
And very briefly, there will also be industrial action around the pay and grading for non-teaching staff education workers.
Well, it will count what appears in the budget today, Stephen, but if the pay and grading review for education workers, which, remember, is an agreement between their employer and their trade unions, if that pay and grading review does not deliver today through the Northern Ireland budget, then there is no question there will be an explosion of anger. I think, first of all, there'll be deep disappointment amongst non-teaching education workers in Northern Ireland. I think that will be followed by an explosion of anger, and I think we should expect to see serious and significant industrial action in the run-up to the summer, and if it's not resolved by then, serious and significant industrial action continuing into the autumn. I really hope that doesn't happen. I really hope the Northern Ireland budget today addresses this critical issue. And one of the thoughts that's in our mind about this is every single political party we talk to agrees.
And the run-up to the summer means you're affecting children's exams.
Well, I think that there is no doubt at all the level of chaos that's going to erupt in schools can have very serious consequences. Obviously, we would take whatever steps we can to avoid disruption.
Would you avoid disruption to kids' exams that they've worked all year for?
I think one of the problems you have now, Stephen, is if the Assembly takes this decision, if the Assembly was to say we are not addressing pay and grading, well then, they know where we are in the school timetable.
But the
they
children
know where
suffer.
We are. And, well, put it this way here, Stephen, if we get into industrial action, will there be an impact? Yes, there will, of course.
Yeah, but you effortlessly said there in the run-up to the summer, knowing that that's the time when a kid's exams, and those exams could be the difference between a kid being motivated about education, a child getting a grade that they've worked many years to achieve, a child's sense of self, and you shouldn't be defined by your grades, but you know what I mean. It is so important to a child, and here you are going to potentially disrupt their exams.
Well, let's be very clear about this, Dave. This pay and grading review was negotiated extensively for 2 years. An agreement was reached between the employer and the trade unions that this was a pay and grading review that had reached this point by consent. So there isn't an agreement. Can you think of any other occasion where an agreement has been reached like this in the public service, where the government then says, we will not fund that? Now, that's the reality. And you have to remember, we are talking about workers in education who are impoverished. They are impoverished. My point, Stephen, is...
We're going to the news.
You cannot control explosions of anger. they will happen.
Okay.
Because the Assembly said they would sort this out, and they need to sort
it
out.
Well, Patrick Mulholland, thank you very much. You will be hearing here on Radio Ulster today about the budget. There's Patrick Mulholland saying if those education staff don't get what they want, serious industrial action in the run-up to the summer during exam time. We've had a statement in from the Lady Chief Justice after our programming at the top of the show this morning. I'll read it to you. We contacted her office. A spokesperson from the Lady Chief Justice Office commented that in accordance with the Contempt of Court Act 1981, conduct may be treated as a contempt of court as tending to interfere with the course of justice, in particular legal proceedings, regardless of intent to do so. So that statement's basically saying whether these people had any knowledge that they were potentially breaking the law or not, they don't have to have intent to. It's whether they have or not. Essentially what that first line from the Lady Chief Justice is saying, this is with regards to the commentary outside Newry Court yesterday when Sir Geoffrey Donaldson was leaving. Lady Chief Justice Office then says, it will be a matter for the PSNI to investigate should a complaint be made regarding the videos which were made outside the court precincts. It'll be a matter for the PSNI to investigate should a complaint be made regarding the videos which were made outside the court precincts. Now, we're going to go back to the Lady Chief Justice Office. In fact, we already have, because I don't understand this. So here's what we're currently asking, because it's about understanding the law. And if the BBC can provide any help with that, of course we will. So here's what we're asking. We've gone back and we've asked the following. Does the judge in this case at the Magistrates Court, Eamon King, have any concerns about what was posted online following yesterday's court appearance by Sir Geoffrey Donaldson and Lady Eleanor Donaldson? Does the Lady Chief Justice have any concerns about what was posted online? Does a complaint of contempt have to be made before it's investigated? In other words, can the authorities, can the Lady Chief Justice, can the judge instruct, can the police take the lead? Should they take the lead if there is stuff being posted online well beyond what any mainstream media outlet would be saying or doing at this moment? Does it need a complaint? Especially given the point that we were asking about earlier, given how quickly material can become viral online. So I'm trying to understand here in this high profile case how and what is the thinking of the authorities around protecting the integrity of our judicial system. And it seems from that opening statement, that first statement that we've had from the Lady Chief Justice, it'll be a matter for the PSNI to investigate. Well, that's a statement of fact. But can any of these offices take the lead, use their initiative to protect our legal system, and should they? So we've gone back to them with those questions and we'll let you know what they say to us. Now, next this morning, an Alliance Party Assembly member who unexpectedly resigned had been facing an investigation from a Northern Ireland Assembly Standards Watchdog. This is coming from our BBC newsroom. Let's get more from our political reporter, Brendan Hughes. So what's happened here, Brendan? Good morning.
Good morning, Stephen. Well, this was very much unexpected whenever the Alliance Party on Tuesday night released a statement in which they said that Patrick Brown had resigned as South Down MLA with immediate effect due to personal reasons. They said in that statement that they thanked him for his service and wished him well in his future endeavours. And in that statement, we also had a comment from Patrick Brown. He thanked the people of South Down for their support over the years and said that the Alliance Party continues to have his support. And in relation to the reasons for this sudden departure, he said that next month he will have been an elected representative for 10 years, both at council level and more recently in the Assembly, and that he felt that the time was right to step aside for personal reasons. So that was the reason given on Tuesday night by both the Alliance Party and Patrick Brown, but it appears further information has emerged since then which gives more context to that sudden departure. We understand that Patrick Brown had been facing an investigation from the Assembly's Standards Commissioner. This investigation followed a complaint made last year about Patrick Brown's conduct towards Shimna Integrated College in Newcastle in County Down and its Board of Governors. Now, it's understood a report by the Standards Commissioner, Dr. Melissa McCulloch, is being considered by the Assembly's Standards and Privileges Committee. So this is a committee that's made up of MLAs from different parties, and it considers investigations by the Commissioner, and it recommends to the wider Assembly later on whether any sanction should be imposed. Now, just to remember the timeline of this, so Patrick Brown, his resignation was announced on Tuesday night by the Alliance Party. Well, we understand that Patrick Brown had been due to attend that Standards and Privileges Committee the following morning, so on the Wednesday morning. Now, we're not sure whether he turned up for that meeting because of two factors, really. Firstly, he's no longer an MLA, and also these meetings are held behind closed doors. But I think it is also worth pointing out that while Patrick Brown has resigned now as an Assembly member for the South Down constituency, we understand that investigation will continue and a report is expected to be released at the end of that process.
Okay. Brendan, thank you very much indeed. Good morning to you. 030 30 80 55 55 is the number to call this morning. The text 81771. And if you're sending a story into the programme today, it is nolan@bbc.co.uk. There are a huge amount of you who are now listening to the programme on BBC Sounds. You can download BBC Sounds on your app. Why would you want to do that? Well, you get the whole range of different BBC programmes. If it's a Nolan show, then you can choose when you listen to it. Maybe 9 o'clock in the morning doesn't suit you. Maybe another time does. And it'll be sitting there for you all day for you to download on BBC Sounds. And Nolan Live is coming back on BBC One, of course, in a couple of weeks' time. So that will be on Wednesday nights on BBC One. And the very last thing to remind you is how important it is for you to send your stories to us. And your stories come in to us, nolan@bbc.co.uk. nolan@bbc.co.uk is how you can send your stories into the programme. Right, so that's enough of all of that from me. Let's talk about some of those stories, shall we? We've heard concerns that adults in Northern Ireland seeking assessment for ADHD are being forced to go private because of a lack of referral services in some areas. I've been speaking to Stephanie, who had contacted the show about her own experiences of getting diagnosed and treated for ADHD as an adult. I began by asking her how difficult it was to get diagnosis here in Northern Ireland.
It's extremely difficult to get a diagnosis, Stephen. So I am 41 years old and I was diagnosed last year at the age of 40. For me, the process, it happened, I think, quite quickly because I had a bee in my bonnet about it and I really, really fought hard to get a diagnosis. This all stemmed from when my son was diagnosed with ADHD and I had started perimenopause, which actually happens, you know, this happens to all women. But whenever my son was diagnosed or going through the process of being diagnosed with ADHD and I was looking up information on social media and whatever the algorithm put together, ADHD and perimenopause, it turns out that actually an awful lot of women, because of hormonal changes, their symptoms are exacerbated.
What were your symptoms, Stephanie?
So my symptoms were I couldn't focus. I have my own business and I couldn't focus at all on doing finances, on sending emails, on making phone calls. My concentration had just gone. And my capabilities, I just didn't feel that I was a capable person anymore in my everyday life. My emotions were all over the place. I was crying a lot. There was like a rage inside of me. I just felt so frustrated that I felt as though I couldn't function as I previously, you know, had done, and I didn't understand why.
That must have been pretty disturbing for you.
It was. Pardon me. I really thought that I was losing my mind. And then when I started really investigating, could I possibly have ADHD? I found that I actually had a lot of the traits that or symptoms that women would have. Women would demonstrate to have their symptoms differently to men. Men would be traditionally or typically, they would be manifested externally, you know, with the fidgeting and the movement and the hyperactivity. But with women, it's very much internal, and our mind just doesn't stop running. It's like a motor. And so that's what it was like for me.
When you then tried to get the diagnosis, what happened?
Mm-hmm. So I went to my GP, and because there is a strong genetic link, if your child has been diagnosed, there's a strong genetic link that one of the parents has a neurological condition. And so I went to the GP and I said, look, these are my symptoms. I wrote like a 4-page document. These are my symptoms. I really feel strongly that I have this condition. What do I do from here? And my GP said, well, there's nothing that I can really do. There's a pediatric pathway, but there's nothing for adults.
Hold on a minute. There's got to be a process where an adult can be diagnosed.
Not in Northern Ireland. Not in Northern Ireland.
Are you sure?
If you're in mainland UK, then there's different pathways. There's the NHS pathway, but there's a very long waiting list for that. And then there's what's called a right to choose, where I think it's down a private route. I'm not entirely sure, because it wasn't an option, you know, for me living in Northern Ireland.
So you were literally told by your doctor, there's no way you can get diagnosed anytime soon.
Yeah, that's it. And
were you told what the waiting list was to eventually be diagnosed?
It was about 4 years or something like that. But there was no waiting list for me to be put on. There was nothing. Unless I were to hit rock bottom and be what's considered a danger to myself or to other people, then community mental health would have to get involved. But sure, you don't want somebody to reach that stage. You know, that sounded a little bit ridiculous. I need to be a fully functioning adult and parent.
Department of Health are saying provision of service for ADHD assessment and diagnosis has grown across Trust in recent years in response to population demand.
Yeah.
So they're saying the provision of service, the provision of assessment and diagnosis service has grown. I wonder, are they talking about kids and adults there? They then say Health and Social Care Trusts are committed to working closely and collaboratively to develop innovative, cost-effective, co-produced, quality, evidence-based services can meet the needs of patients in ADHD.
Mm-hmm.
Department is considering the future direction of travel for the commissioning of adult ADHD services.
Yes.
So I wonder, well, the bottom line is you couldn't get it on the NHS.
I couldn't get it on the NHS. There are some private clinics that offer this service, but obviously you have to pay an awful lot for this. I decided, do you know what? I want to go down this route, because I've been on antidepressants and anti-anxiety medication for around 20 years. And I know that I'm not depressed. You know, obviously everybody has trauma in their life to some extent. You know, we're at different points. There are different things that happen to people. But I'm not a depressed person. And I don't think I'm overly anxious. But this is what I had been prescribed to manage, you know, symptoms, I suppose, of ADHD for the last 20 years. And I don't want to be on those anymore. Or I didn't want to be on those anymore.
So did you go private?
I did go private. I went private A friend of mine recommended a triage nurse who works with a private psychiatrist. That route has now closed, unfortunately. I think I was one of the last people to go down that route. So I had a private assessment with a triage nurse who would then, she spoke to me for about 2 or 3 hours in Belfast in a private room, privately hired room. And then she sent me away with a 30-page, form that I had to fill in to demonstrate that I had symptoms before the age of 12, I think, and then afterwards that it had continued on into adulthood. And somebody with ADHD, one of the major, issues or something that they can find very, very hard to do is paperwork. So I actually had a friend sit with me and she helped me fill in this form with mine.
And what was your diagnosis?
Moderate to severe ADHD.
So you would have had to have waited 4 years on the NHS.
Mm-hmm.
And you were moderate to severe.
Yeah.
And you've now, presumably, if you got that diagnosis, you can get treatment to help.
Well, that was another issue. I was then put through to the psychiatrist let me just get my timings back last year at the beginning of the summer, and I met with the psychiatrist and he gave me a private prescription for medication to access the medication that would help manage the symptoms. So it would help manage my focus and clarity in my head, that I would be able to start and finish tasks and not get so overwhelmed. But this was a private prescription, and you can't just go to your local chemist or pharmacy with a private prescription. It has to go through a private GP to write the prescription that you then take to the chemist.
All of this takes money, of course.
All of this costs money.
And
yes,
what chance has anybody got that can't find the money?
Yeah, exactly. So I was able to access my medication through a private GP in Belfast, and every month now I pay almost £80 to get the medication that has had a massive impact on my life.
£80 a month?
Yes.
Wow.
And that doesn't count the reviews that I have with the psychiatrist, because it's a controlled 2-type drug. So you need to have your blood pressure checked to make sure that, you know, everything is okay, and other checks. But this all has to be done with the private psychiatrist, because there's no shared care agreement with GPs. They won't take on that level of care.
What difference has the medication made to you?
It has completely changed my life. Previously, I felt really lost and unclear in my thoughts, and it has really helped me with clarity. I'm able to manage on a day-to-day basis with my life, with my business. I'm able to start and finish tasks. I'm able to I feel so much happier in myself and just more competent and back to the way that I was feeling before all the hormonal changes, if you like.
Wow. So it's been game changing for you. It's been life changing.
It has been life changing. Now, the medication, there are different kinds of medication that you can get. And some people decide not to pursue the medicated route, and that's absolutely fine. But I thought, no, I actually want to give this. I want to give this a try and see if it can help me. And it does take a long time to get onto the right dose as well. It's called titration. So I'm still in the titration process of finding the right level of medication for me. But then under the care of my psychiatrist, I am weaning myself off the antidepressants, which is fantastic. And I've nearly finished that.
And you've come to me because you feel other people should be able to get this help on the NHS.
I really, really strongly do, because there's a child, there's a paediatric pathway, and because there is a strong link between, strong genetic link between, you know, parents and their children, it's very, very likely that when a child gets diagnosed, that the parent will then go and research all of the traits and do all the different, you know, find out as much as they can, and they'll start thinking themselves, oh my goodness, I recognize these traits in myself. And then their child is getting the medication maybe that they need, and then the child is able to focus better at school or manage their symptoms and their emotions better if they choose to pursue the medication route. But then there isn't that option for the parents. And this is incredibly, incredibly frustrating that the parent isn't getting treated if they want to be treated. So this is what I would really love, is that the parents would be offered an assessment should they choose.
Well, look, the contribution that people like you make, and it's sharing a very personal story. So first of all, thank you for trusting us with it, and I'm sure that other people listening to this story, they'll be able to identify with it, and we'll continue the discussion about it. Is that all right?
Thank you so much. I really appreciate
all right.
that.
Lovely to talk to you, and I hope you're well. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
Right. It's a really interesting story, that, isn't it? And it comes back to that current, that continual theme that we seem to have on this programme. If you don't have the money, what do you do? For people that can go private or are dipping into their savings to go private, that's an out for them with a cost. But what if you don't have the money in the first place? What on earth do you do? Nolan@bbc.co.uk is our email. Michaela is a campaigner and consultant for businesses looking to introduce disabled bathrooms into public areas. With us this morning, Michaela, good morning.
Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning. So, is there enough toilet facilities in public areas for disabled people?
Ask me that question when you can visit any town and any public building and use the bathroom, regardless of your physical or other disability, then I will say yes. At the moment, there's not, but we're certainly making great strides to make sure that that is the case, especially in the UK and Northern Ireland.
So how bad is the situation?
It's tough, Stephen. I mean, where I live in Crossgar, most people, I think, know that. There's really none in my council area that are public-facing. But if you take a trip to Belfast and Belfast City Centre, there's about five or six that are all walking distance with one another. So we are making really good progress. We have our newest toilet has opened in Titanic, Belfast, which I think will be groundbreaking for not only Northern Ireland and tourists visiting Northern Ireland, but also about spreading the word of changing places toilets, which are toilets that have a hoist and a bench for people like me with a severe physical disability and other disabilities as well, so that you can meet your needs outside of the home. So we are really making progress. It's just that we really need to push forward and see, you know, the but new building regulations have come into force, which means that some new buildings, which are public-facing buildings, will be required to have a changing places toilet, as well as standard accessible toilets. So we are moving in the right direction. We're setting, there's around 2,000 changing places toilets across the UK. We're a little bit behind per head of population in Northern Ireland, but we're rapidly catching that up.
There are not enough toilets, full stop,
no.
in public spaces, are there, for both people with a disability and people without a disability? And then what do you find in lots of these shops who are legally required to have a toilet? You see a sign on their door all year round, out of order.
Yeah,
and they're conning the system, and they're getting away with it because they're legally required to have a toilet, and they think they're getting away with it by sticking an out of order sign on the door all year round.
Absolutely, and my go to phrase for this, Stephen, and I'm sure you'll appreciate this, is it's the year 2024. We are talking about sending humans to Mars. We have sent humans to the moon. got to be yes with the toilet on Earth. And it's absolutely ludicrous. And I mean, people are being forced into surgical procedures. People are being forced into wearing incontinence underwear when they're not incontinent because they can't access bathrooms. And I'm really sorry, but I just don't think that's how we should be treating people and humans in 2024.
So what can we do about it? How can we hold these people to account?
For me, I think it's about actually understanding what it's like to go all day without access to bathrooms. You know, I regularly have to go 8, 9, 10 hours a day with no access to public bathrooms.
Yeah.
It's not on, and I think people need to understand that going to the bathroom is not a luxury. We are not living in a country that is financially struggling to such an extent that we need to deny clean, hygienic, safe and accessible toilet facilities to people. And they just need to listen to people with lived experience, like myself, like other toilet campaigners with Malia and Dermot. There are so many of us who are also willing to help. Come talk to us. We're here to make the solution better.
Yeah, well, we need to stay across this, don't we? And we need to see what... we need to hold these people accountable, and these organisations and these shops and buildings accountable. Michaela, thank you as always. Nice to talk to you this morning. Thanks, everyone. We'll see you in the morning when we'll start again at 9 o'clock. Have a good day. Bye-bye.
The biggest show in the country. Listen again on BBC Sounds. Tweet at Stephen Nolan.
The world is facing a shortage of tradespeople. The metaverse can help solve that problem. With a virtual reality training platform developed by ForgeFX, aspiring welders can practice over and over. As a result, students learn the specialized skills they need to begin and advance welding careers. Meta and the metaverse are having impact today.
Ich bin Lea.
Ich bin Lina und wir machen den Podcast Juice.
Das hier ist Juice und da erzählen wir uns gegenseitig jede Woche eine juicy Geschichte aus der Community. Egal, ob die jetzt schockierend, peinlich oder einfach nur funny ist.
Zum Beispiel die Geschichte über Raphael, der eine Hodenkrankheit vortäuscht, nur um sein Date im Krankenhaus zu besuchen.
Die Ärztin so, naja, können wir den Hoden auch antackern.
Hört Juice überall, wo es Podcasts gibt. Wir freuen uns. It's spicy, you tell me, yeah.